nature at all levels of biological organization, from the technocrats who want to create new life forms via synthetic biology, all the way to the geoengineers who want to get their hands on the planetary thermostat. This is the panel that you would want to assemble. It's an eminent bunch, and I'm going to briefly go through all of the bios sequentially, very quickly. And then we won't get around to the flow of talks as we get started. These are going to be very brief, but you know, if you want more information on any of these panelists, you can consult Dr. Google. Clive Hamilton is one of the foremost public intellectuals and social critics of Australia, author of many books, including most recently Earth Masters, Playing God with the Climate. Pat Mooney, co-founder of the ETC Group, indispensable Canadian think tank and technology critic, brilliant technology critic, and winner of the Right Livelihood Award. The indefatigable activist, Debbie Barker, a former executive director of the International Forum on Globalization, currently with the Center for Food Safety, and co-author of Fatal Harvest. Jim Thomas, also of the ETC Group in Canada, leading thinker on the perils of synthetic biology. And then we will have a very brief film excerpt from an hour-long film. We're going to see about 5 minutes of the film DNA Dreams. You have met Andy Kimbrell at the International Center for Technology Assessment this morning, author of many books, including relevant to the topic you'll address today, The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. And last but not least, journalist and author Katie Singer, author most recently of the brand new and landmark book, An Electronic Silent Spring, who is going to help illuminate the fog of electronic pea soup in which we are all stewing at this very moment. Thank you very much, and I will give the floor to Clive Hamilton.
Thanks very much, Andy, for that introduction, and to the organizers for putting together this terrific event. Well, it's now clear. It's now clear that the range of emission paths mapped out by the experts in the 1990s and early 2000s were unduly optimistic. The actual growth path of carbon and greenhouse gas emissions, boosted by explosive growth in China, has described a pathway that is worse than the worst-case scenario. Since the early 2000s, the anxiety of those who watch or this most closely, that is the climate scientists, escalated as their work began to focus more and more on the dangers of feedback effects in the climate system, that is, processes that amplify or dampen the direct warming effect of increasing greenhouse gas emissions, such as feedback effects such as the melting Arctic ice cap, which exposes water that is darker than the highly reflective ice that it displaces, and this water, darker water, absorbs more heat from the sun. The study of feedback effects has been closely related to that of tipping points, thresholds that may see the climate flip into a new state from which there is no going back. The discovery in the Earth's geological record of many instances of abrupt shifts from one state to another prompted the esteemed paleoclimatologist Wally Crocker to warn, the paleoclimate record shouts out to us that far from being self-stabilizing, the Earth's climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts even to small nudges. Against this background, scientists began to talk about possible responses to a climate emergency, such as a massive methane release from melting permafrost, which may mean a new word for the permafrost, the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet, or rapid dieback of the Amazon forests. How, they asked, Could we intervene to prevent these things happening? If plan A, persuading the world to cut greenhouse gas emissions, is failing, shouldn't we have a plan B? Geoengineering is the deliberate, large-scale intervention in the climate system designed to counter global warming or to offset some of its effects. And if you look up Google under geoengineering, you'll see that more than 40 schemes have been put forward, with some now, perhaps 6 or 7 of them, the subject of intensive research. And these schemes are usually divided into two types. Methods known as carbon dioxide removal, such as capturing carbon dioxide from the ambient air and piping it and storing it somewhere, making biochar, that is fixing the carbon in organic matter, which you hope will last for many centuries before breaking down, and the third method, adding lime to the oceans to counter the effects of ocean acidification so that the ocean can keep absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And the second type of geoengineering method are known as solar radiation management, and they are aimed at increasing the Earth's albedo or its reflectivity. And methods include painting roofs white, putting mirrors in space to deflect some of the sunlight reaching the Earth, and brightening marine clouds. I can't talk about all of those schemes, but I do want to focus on that scheme which is receiving the most attention and the one most likely to be deployed in the next 20 or 30 years, and that's known as sulfate aerosol spray. And the proposal is to spray sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, in the stratosphere, and they would form tiny particles known as aerosols, and these aerosols would, in a suitable thickness for this upper atmospheric cloud, they would reflect an extra 1 or 2% of incoming solar radiation back into space, thereby cooling the planet. Incidentally, this has nothing to do with chemtrails. There is no scientific basis whatever for any of the various claims of chemtrails, and they should not be treated seriously. The aim of sulfate aerosol spraying would be to mimic the effects of volcanic eruptions, an observation which has been made for a long time, that volcanic eruptions cool the planet. The particles spewed into the atmosphere by large eruptions have been known to cool the planet by a degree or more for 2 or 3 or even 4 years. And they also, volcanic eruptions, change the colour of the sky. In 1883, the spectacular sunsets in Oslo, which followed the eruption of Mount Krakatoa in Indonesia a few months earlier, inspired Edvard Munch to go back to the studio and write that he had felt that nature was emitting an enormous scream, and he then, as a result, painted the scream. It's remarkable, actually, how much great artistic output has been the result of volcanic eruptions. William Turner's our skies, for example, were influenced by them. The most likely delivery method for sulfate aerosols is a fleet of customised high-flying aircraft fitted with tanks and spraying equipment. In effect, humans would be installing a radiative shield between the Earth and the Sun. One could be adjusted by those who control it to regulate the temperature of the planet. All of the models, and there's been quite a lot of modelling work going on, indicate that if we reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the planet, the Earth would indeed cool fairly quickly and fairly evenly, although with less effect at the poles. The models also show that rainfall would be returned some way towards pre-warming patterns. But other studies show that the Indian monsoon could be seriously disrupted, affecting food supplies for 1 billion or so people. Although, as you pointed out, the disruption may be less than would occur with warming and without the solar filter. The unevenness of solar geoengineering's impacts has led one expert to conclude at a conference Berlin a couple of months ago, that the potential for violent conflict from solar radiation management is quite high. The unevenness of the impacts is one reason for the security state to be taking an interest in solar geoengineering. Jane Long, an expert from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, who's been a member of most committees that produce reports advocating increased funding for geoengineering, she recently noted at the same conference, geoengineering is fundamentally strategic, and in the United States, we do not have institutions that are strategic except the military. Already, military organisations are taking an interest. DARPA, the Pentagon's Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency, convened a meeting in 2009 to consider geoengineering. The semi-secret military-linked Jason group of top scientists who advise the US government is also reportedly studying geoengineering, and the CIA has recently commissioned a report. Crucially, sulfate aerosol spray is expected to slow down the repair of the hole in the ozone layer. And of course, it would do nothing to offset the acidification of oceans due to rising carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. Moreover, we cannot know how it would affect the global climate system merely through modeling or even by conducting experiments of sulfate aerosol spraying. Only by full-scale implementation and deployment could we get a clear idea of its impact. And even then, we would need at least 10 years of global climate data before we had enough information to separate signal from noise, that is, enough information to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from natural climate variability and the effects of human-induced climate change. Nevertheless, an influential constituency advocating a major investment program in geoengineering has now emerged. At the centre of this network is a pair of North American scientists actively engaged in that research. David Keith, a Harvard physicist, and Ken Caldera, an atmospheric scientist based at Stanford. For some years, they have been Bill Gates' principal source of expert knowledge on climate change. Gates was persuaded to commit several $1 million to finance research in climate engineering. And Gates is now the world's leading financial supporter of geoengineering research. Richard Branson is in there as well. Gates is an investor in various geoengineering enterprises, including one called Silver Lining, a company pursuing marine cloud brightening methods, and another called Carbon Engineering Limited, company formed by David Keith to develop technology to capture carbon dioxide from ambient air on an industrial scale. Gates is also an investor in a firm known as Intellectual Ventures, a firm led by Nathan Mervold, formerly Chief Technology Officer at Microsoft. The group includes the legendary Pentagon weaponeer and Star Wars leader, Lowell Wood, with his mentor, Edward Teller, his name had to come up sooner or later, Lowell Wood wrote one of the first papers advocating climate engineering as a substitute for carbon abatement. Intellectual Ventures has developed what he calls the Strato Shield, a hose suspended by balloons in the sky to deliver sulfate aerosols on demand. The device, as you can see, is marketed as a practical, low-cost way to reverse catastrophic warming of the Arctic, or the entire planet. In recent years, there's been a flurry of patents taken out over methods to engineer the climate. One of them is so broad that, if the patent were enforceable, it would place fertilisation of the oceans in the hands of one man, who happens to live in Northport, New York. We're approaching a situation in which international efforts to protect humanity from climate catastrophe could depend on whether or not one company wanted to sell its intellectual property. Oil companies, anticipating a shift in the political landscape, are quietly backing research into geoengineering. Royal Dutch Shell is funding a study of lime in the oceans, which, as I said, would reduce the acidification, allowing the oceans to keep absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The chief scientist of oil giant BP was the convener of an expert meeting in 2009 that produced an influential report on climate engineering, including advocacy of a major research program. ExxonMobil, for years the principal funder of climate science disinformation, has inserted itself into climate engineering through its point man on geoengineering, named Haroon Keshti, the leader of Exxon's global climate change program. Yes, they have one. In 1995, Keshti was the first to propose liming the oceans as a means of reducing acidification due to escalating atmospheric carbon. And through Haroon Keshti, Exxon has begun to influence various independent reports in climate engineering, including one by NASA in 2007. Burgeoning commercial engagement in geoengineering is therefore creating a constituency with an interest in more research and eventually deployment. Such a lobby is naturally predisposed to argue that pursuing emission cuts is unrealistic or politically impossible, and therefore geoengineering is the sensible alternative. Already, a chorus of demands for public funding is loud, and governments have begun to show interest. China recently decided to include geoengineering amongst its earth science research priorities. Russia pushed hard for the IPCC to give a firm endorsement of geoengineering in the fifth assessment report that came out last year. The politics of climate engineering are making for some strange bedfellows. Along with neoliberal economists like the authors of Superfreakonomics, right-wing think tanks that have for years promoted denial of climate science are now advocating geoengineering as a substitute for cutting emissions. Those right-wing think tanks include the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Hudson Institute, the Hoover Institution, and even the extremist Heartland Institute, notorious for comparing those who accept climate science with the Unabomber. So what motivates climate science deniers to promote a solution to a problem they've said does not exist? Well, firstly, it confirms that they, these groups, have manufactured the dispute over climate science to hide their fear of the consequences of accepting it. They reject not the science, but its implications for their cultural worldview, namely, that unconstrained capitalism is destroying the planet and far-reaching government intervention is essential. Trashing science is collateral damage in pursuit of ideology. It's well established statistically that in the United States, denial of climate science is much more common among conservative white males than any other demographic group. Aaron McBride and Riley Dunlap, who studied the phenomenon, argue that conservative white males are, quote, likely to favour protection of the current industrial capitalist order, which has historically served them well. They, and the right-wing think tanks that express their view of the world, are more likely to accept that exercising control and authority over both society and nature are natural and desirable, because the alternative means disorder and indecision. That in itself, I think, goes a long way towards explaining this apparent paradox of these conservative think tanks rejecting climate science but supporting climate engineering. The American Enterprise Institute declared that geoengineering, quote, challenges us to take climate policy seriously. Compared to ruinous carbon abatement policies, as a techno fix, geoengineering promises to protect the structure of the economic and political power, including the balance sheets of fossil fuel corporations, the freedom of energy markets, and the rights of consumers to consume whatever they like. Instead of climate change jeopardizing the system, climate engineering would represent its triumph. We know that in the sense of power, engineering and climate is privately discussed. But for the moment, a taboo prevents politicians talking about it in public. The taboo could be broken if the Murdoch press latched onto sulfur aerosol spray. All it would take is one tweet from the dirty digger sitting in his 23rd Street penthouse. It could happen tonight. And his 400 editors around the world will slowly should take up the cause, not to mention Fox News. Just as the world of conservative think tanks and media moguls makes them prone to repudiate climate sciences, so that same worldview makes them prone to support geoengineering. It's true, they have not yet stopped to think about what it means for freedom to have the government controlling the weather, but if it means business as usual, perhaps it's a price they're willing to pay. It has to be stressed, in my final observation, that some of the scientists now researching and arguing with geoengineering are those who are most freaked out about the implications of climate change and have very strong environmental credentials. And it may well come to pass that all environmentalists may be compelled to very seriously consider their moral stance when it comes to allowing the world to get to 4 degrees and the catastrophes that will follow, or supporting the heaviest of parts, sulfate aerosol spray. In the end, it might be remembered that climate engineering is the first major technological program that does not promise to give us a better future. Instead of a techno-utopia, it can only promise an avoided dystopia. If it worked, it would stand as a monument to the ultimate failure of unbridled techno-industrialism and our inability to rein it in. Thank you.